Hello and welcome to this digital content of the class Physical Chemistry of Polymers, which is one out of two classes in the module Introduction to Macromolecular Chemistry taught at the Johannes Gutenberg University of Mainz. The first part of this module is an Organic Chemistry of Polymers class, and you're listening to the second part on Physical Chemistry of Polymers right now. My name is Sebastian Seifert, and I'm a representative of that very field at our university. The core focus of my research and teaching is in that very discipline, Physical Chemistry of Polymers. Before I forget, if you want to get in touch with me, you can do this most effectively and easily, I would say, via email, targeted to the address sebastian.seifert@uni-mainz.de. The first goal of this first digital lesson unit is to announce and clarify some mostly technical details on the lecture content, format, and let's say terms and conditions, and then to get started with the actual lecture content. So then, let's get started with some technical notes on this lecture. The first point is that you hear already that the lecture language in this class is English. For many, if not to say most of you, this is certainly a challenge, which is good, because challenges make you grow. I encourage you to not only view this as a challenge, which it indeed is, but also as a great chance, because with that, in this class, you will not only learn about the fundamentals of physical chemistry of polymers, but also get some notion of a key qualification that you will need for your later profession, which will be some sort of leadership position in either the chemical or materials industry or an academic surrounding, which both will be international and interdisciplinary. To interact in such international and interdisciplinary environments and to lead an international and interdisciplinary research team, you will not only need scientific and technical knowledge, but also fluent English. Our class will give you a first chance to get acquainted with that. A second technical point to be discussed here in this introduction is the types and media with and on which this digital lecture content will reach you. Just as in a classical non-digital, that means personal presence-based lecture format, that has been in use by mankind ever since scientific insights have been discovered, the transfer of scientific knowledge relies on auditive and visual elements. The auditive element is my talking, and the visual element is graphical illustrations, written mathematical expressions, and sketched schematics. Classically, both is delivered together to you in a standard lecture hall format, where a lecturer in front of the learning group talks and uses Blackboard plus projection media for the visual element. In this digital class, there is two realizations of how these two elements of knowledge transfer can reach you. In other words, this digital lecture is offered to you in two different ways of conception. The first way is a video format offered on our university's platform Panopto, where you hear the auditive element from your computer loudspeakers or headphones and concurrently see the visual element on screen. Alternatively, you can also receive and conceive this lecture with the two elements more split. The lecture is also offered to you as a series of audio podcasts that only transfer the auditive element, whereas the visual element can be received parallel to listening to these podcasts on the basis of PDF copies of lecture scripts that come along with the lesson units. These scripts summarize the core content of each lesson unit of the lecture as bullet point note downs alongside two schematic sketches and graphical illustrations, just as handwritten notes that you would take during a classical lecture hall setting of this class would look like. These PDF scripts are actually excerpted from a larger textual basis for this class, which is the textbook Physical Chemistry of Polymers, A Conceptual Introduction, published by De Gruyter, with the first edition having appeared in April 2020. This textbook lays out to you even further content and deeper insight than it is discussed in this digital lecture, and the PDF scripts are sort of short synopses taken from this book. Both the latter is offered to you on the website www.seifert, that's my name with double F, -group.de, which is the web presence of my scientific working group at our university. And on that website, you find a section teaching, and in that section teaching, you find a subsection Physical Chemistry of Polymers 1, and there you find and can play the audio podcasts, and there you also find the PDF copies of the lecture scripts for download. Depending on what type of learning person you are, either the converged video broadcast on Panopto or the split audio podcast listening alongside to reading or viewing at the lecture scripts may be more suitable for you. Both is possible for you to do by choosing the one or the other format for conceiving this class. If you're uncertain what is your preference, I suggest that you just try out both. Use the one format for the first lesson unit and use the other format for the second lesson unit and then compare and see what works better for you. Along with the lecture, there is also an exercise on which format and terms and conditions you find information on our lecture website. One last technical point that is certainly on all your minds is, what about the exam? Classically, this exam has always taken place at the end of the semester, most typically on the last Thursday of the last week of the semester term, demanding from you both an organic and a physical chemistry part to be solved, both of which designated to take a time of 60 minutes each. So in total, the working time for the exam is 120 minutes. And whereas the organic chemistry part of this exam typically features questions like how a reaction mechanism looks like for formation of a certain kind of polymer or reaction of a certain kind of monomer, the physical chemistry part of the exam more targets at quantitative calculation of specific problems from our lecture content, similar to how the exercises in our exercise look like, along with conceptual questions targeting at the fundamental understanding of the lecture content taught in our physical chemistry part of the class. The physical chemistry part of the exam is given out to you in two languages, both German and English, and you're free to pick either language to solve it. Most of the questions are mathematical anyways, so for those, language at all is irrelevant, apart from the universal language of mathematics. And those questions where language is indeed required can be answered by you in either the German or the English language. So far, even mixtures of these languages were okay to us. Meaning so far it was perfectly fine if you answered question number one in English language, question number two in German language, and sometimes even mixtures within the same exercise were tolerated by us. What is not possible, however, is that you answer one and the same question in both languages and then expect a double amount of points to it, which I hope is a matter of common sense anyways. Okay, after having detailed on these terms and conditions, I would like to discuss the more fundamental and interesting questions, which is the what and why of this lecture. You know that chemistry commonly is classified in different subfields. The largest and most famous ones in general are inorganic chemistry, organic chemistry, and physical chemistry. There is also lots of further fields into which chemistry can be categorized, such as analytical chemistry, biochemistry, theoretical chemistry, supramolecular chemistry, and so on. The order of naming these subfields that I have just mentioned is according to their historical emergence. Analytical chemistry is actually quite established already. Biochemistry is somewhat newer. Theoretical chemistry is also somewhat newer. Supramolecular chemistry, to me, is actually the newest subfield of chemistry, tracing back to the Nobel Prize given in 1987. And in this row of fields, certainly a further one must be named, and this is macromolecular chemistry. This field traces back to the year 1920, so it is quite exactly 100 years old now. And we will see towards the end of this present first lesson unit what made this year the origin of a new subfield of chemistry. In a classical lecture hall setting of this class, at this point, I commonly ask a question to the students in the audience. And this question is, where in your lives did you come across polymers already? Maybe even today. And after some time of thinking, there is some shout-ins from the audience, such as, in shoe soles, or in plastic bags, or in furniture, or in smartphone cases. If we collect this list a little more, we get to the conclusion that polymers are everywhere, also in ourselves, in life. Life forms, actually, are based on polymers. There is an expression by the German polymer scientist Bruno Vollmatt, who wrote a beautiful bedtime story teaching book, I always say, entitled Grundriss der makromolekularen Chemie, which is, polymers are the highest level of complexity in chemistry and the lowest level of complexity in biology. But why are polymers so relevant, both for the biological life science and the material science? Well, I would say because they display a wide variety of properties that are tunable on the basis of the primary chemical structure. So polymers are a stereotype example of a class of materials whose properties are versatile and rationally understandable and designable by structure-property relations. This is what this lecture is targeted at. In physical chemistry of polymers, we aim to achieve an understanding of the relations between structure and properties of polymers, which means to connect molecular parameters to macroscopic functions. The advantage of doing this is because once we have that understanding, we can do the reverse, the opposite, meaning to perform rational design of polymer-based materials. This connection actually bridges the fields of polymer chemistry and polymer engineering. This is illustrated in figure 1. In this figure, you see a continent on the left-hand side representing polymer chemistry and another continent on the right-hand side representing polymer materials engineering. And these two continents are separated from each other by a seemingly impassable water body, but there is a bridge that arcs between them provided by physical chemistry of polymers. And this bridge rests on three solid pillars. These are the three sub-chapters or subdomains in physical chemistry of polymers, which is single-chain statistics, multi-chain interactions, and chain dynamics. All these three will be in the scope of this present lecture. And if we stay in this picture, we get an illustration of what this bridge does to us. Namely, it bridges chemical structures to macroscopic engineering properties. And this means we can walk this bridge in either direction and understand what primary chemical structure causes a certain beneficial property, and vice versa. We can say that if we want to engineer a material that has a certain beneficial property for a designated application, then this material must have this and that primary chemical structure. This is what we mean with structure-property relations, which are given to us by physical chemistry of polymers. And this is actually what you will do in your later profession. If you find yourselves being a developing material scientist in the function of a laboratory leader, the core concept of your work will look as follows. Users, applicants, or in other words, customers, are usually not interested in a chemical structure. They don't care about the beauty of the molecule. What they are interested in, what they care about instead, is a function. And as material scientists, what you must do is to translate this desired function into measurable physical parameters, and then go ahead and translate those into a primary chemical structure. In the field of physical chemistry of polymers, these structure-property relations often turn out to be mathematical scaling laws, meaning we have connections between quantities of interest that follow the mathematical form of a power law. One of the most fundamental power law interdependencies that we will come across multiple times throughout this lecture is the power law scaling of the size of a polymer coil, which is given by its squared chain end-to-end distance or radius of duration. We will get to know what these quantities exactly are in the next lesson unit. And the number and lengths of segments of monomeric repeating units that constitute the polymer. The scaling law reads R square is C infinity times N times L square. R square is the mean square size of the polymer coil. C infinity is a quantity named characteristic ratio that we will get to know in more detail also in our next lesson unit. N is the number of segments and L is the segmental length in the chain. Whereas the parameter C infinity, the characteristic ratio, is specific to each specific polymer type, the rest of the equation, the N times L square part, is universal and applies in that form to all polymers. So we see that the chemical specificity is captured by the parameter C infinity, whereas physical universality is captured in the scaling N times L square. So what we also see in this context is that there is some universality and some specificity in polymers. There is some properties that are universal for all polymers, captured by physics, and some that are specific for a specific given polymer at hand, given by its specific chemical identity. Another example for this reflection of both physical universality and chemical specificity is the phenomenon of the glass transition. This is a phenomenon that is shown by all polymer materials. It's actually shown by many other materials also, but it's very striking for polymer materials, which is that if we cool down a polymeric melt at some point, there will be a freezing of the chain dynamics, meaning of the segmental motion in the system. And that means that although at this point the structure is still amorphous, like in a fluid, there is no longer any dynamics, like in a solid. Such a state that has a non-crystalline but amorphous structure without any molecular dynamics is named a glass. Little footnote in this context, why is this glass transition phenomenon seen for all polymers, but not for many classical low molar mass melts? The reason is the large size and chain type connectivity of polymers. When cooling down a common normal low molar mass material, at some point we pass the freezing point where a crystalline solid body gets thermodynamically more favorable than an amorphous fluid phase, and so the molecules arrange themselves on defined positions on a crystalline lattice. For polymers, this process has two decisive prerequisites. First of all, placing of the segmental units on regular crystalline lattice positions must actually be possible, which means the kind of connectivity along the polymer chain must be highly regular, which is often not the case, as we will see later on throughout this lesson unit. Second, even if this is given, placing of these mutually connected monomer units on regular crystalline lattice positions takes long times. And if our rate of cooling is just too fast, and any normal rate of cooling is already too fast in this context, this process does not have enough time to occur. And so what happens instead is a freezing of the chain dynamics with no placement of the chain segments on regular lattice positions, just because they didn't have enough time to do so until the temperature has already dropped below the point underneath which chain dynamics is already frozen in. And so what happens before the crystallization is glassy solidification, also named vitrification, resulting in a glassy state, a state with amorphous structure but frozen dynamics. Hence, the occurrence of a glass transition is universal and observed for all polymers, meaning this is universality set by physics. The specific point where this happens, however, has to do with the ease or non-ease of mutual monomer displacement. And that has to do with the stiffness or non-stiffness of the bonds between the monomer units, specifically of the ease or non-ease of rotatability of the monomer units against each other along the chain backbone. And that in turn has to do with their specific chemical substitution pattern, with the bulkiness and interactions of substituents along the chain backbone. So this is specificity set by chemistry that dictates at what temperature exactly the glass transition occurs. In our lecture, it is our goal to understand the basics, the fundament of such relations, to erect the bridge sketched in figure 1 that arcs between polymer chemistry and polymer engineering. We will do so in 4 chapters. The first chapter is the one you're listening to right now, Introduction. In this chapter, we will delineate the field of macromolecular chemistry and define some terms, along with having a little glimpse on the so far history of development of this field. The second chapter is entitled Ideal Polymer Chains. You may recall the starting point into elementary physical chemistry that you once had throughout your chemistry studies. What you discussed first in the introductory physical chemistry 1 lecture, after some general introduction and some mathematical background, was the most simple state of matter imaginable at all, which is the ideal gas. We will do the same when approaching polymers and discuss a very simplified, actually oversimplified conception of them, which is so-called ideal chains. And we will get to know some statistical approaches to describe the structure of such ideal polymer chains. And as we will see, this will lead us already to one of the most fundamental properties of polymers, which is their entropy-based chain elasticity. Further following this analogy, just like in physical chemistry 1, where at some point you realize that the ideal gas model has limitations, which then led you to the real gas model, in chapter number 3 of our class, we will discuss real polymer chains and take into account aspects that we have ignored in the ideal chain recognition, which is interactions within the coils and potential solvents in their surrounding. In chapter number 4, we will get even one step further and discuss interactions not only within a single coil, but also between coils. So there, for the first time, we will actually discuss multi-chain systems in view of discussing thermodynamics of polymer systems. With that, we have not yet erected the bridge in figure 1. What we have erected actually is the fundament, the 3 pillars of this bridge. To actually then erect the bridge on top of that, we need to discuss more. And as an outlook, I can advertise already at this point, the class Physical Chemistry of Polymers 2, taught on master levels at the University of Mainz, that will erect that very bridge, meaning that will deliver actual structure property relations. The most relevant properties of polymers that have most decisively shaped our lives and use of them in the last century is their mechanical properties. So this lecture will have a large focus on rheology and mechanics of polymer systems. And as we want to discover structure property relations, we also need some knowledge on how to determine structures experimentally. The first part of this lecture series gives us a quite decent theoretical fundament of how to describe structures theoretically, but what we are still lacking to this late point of our lecture series is a notion on how to determine this and thereby to challenge our theoretical pictures experimentally. The most relevant and versatile class of technologies for that purpose in the field of polymer science is scattering methods. So the second class of this lecture series also targets at introducing those, and with that it actually only has 2 chapters. A large chapter on rheology and mechanics of polymer systems, and another not so large but still content-rich chapter on scattering analysis of polymer systems. Let's get started with some fundamentals. Let's define some terms. In polymer chemistry, we use 2 expressions more or less synonymously, the term macromolecule and the term polymer. I would like to get started with this lecture by delimiting these terms from each other. Let's have a look at figure 2. Here we see some kinds of chemical, biological, and technical small entities within which macromolecules find themselves kind of in the center. Macromolecules are certainly larger than normal molecules and atoms, but they are smaller than other objects from other fields, such as the field of biology. They are smaller than biological objects, such as viruses, vesicles, and cells. So here we see already once more that macromolecules take a center position between chemistry and biology. They are the largest level of complexity in chemistry and the lowest level of complexity in biology. The term macromolecule is composed of two words, the Greek macro, which means large, and the word molecule in its common meaning to us. Little footnote in this context, molecule actually derives from the Latin molecula, which means small mass. So when we take this together, a macromolecule would actually be a large small mass, which is kind of a contradiction. But I think we know what is meant with macromolecule. This term refers to large molecules. And when they are large, they are also heavy, as also denoted to us in figure 2. With macromolecule, we address molecules with sizes in the range of some tens to hundreds of nanometers and molar masses of some thousands to hundred thousands up to millions of grams per mole. Delimited from that is the term polymer. This is also a word composed of two Greek parts. The first part, poly, means many, and the second part, meros, means parts. Polymers, therefore, are molecules composed of many parts. They are most commonly chain molecules constituted of a sequence of many repeating units. These units are named monomers. In summary, we can therefore say that the term macromolecule refers to any sort of large molecule, whereas the term polymer refers to those large molecules built of a repeating sequence of structural units, the so-called monomer units. That means we can constitute that each polymer is a macromolecule, but not each macromolecule is a polymer. Somewhat questionable in that context are biopolymers, such as proteins or polynucleic acids, because whereas on the one hand they are built of a sequence of units, namely amino acids or nucleotides, this is not a stoically repeating sequence of always the same structural unit, but by contrast proteins display a variety of sequences of 20 natural amino acids, and DNA/RNA displays a rich variety of local structures of four kinds of nucleotides, respectively. This is actually the basis of carrying information and of having highly specific key and lock functions in these molecules. I would like to refrain from this rather pea-picking discussion as to whether or not proteins and polynucleic acids are polymers or not, but suggest that we can perfectly agree on naming them biopolymers. And that's it. In general, when we are uncertain about the adequateness of a term in chemistry, we can always address IUPAC, which has a definition for everything, also for polymers. And according to this institution, a polymer is defined as a molecule of high relative molecular mass, the structure of which essentially comprises the multiple repetition of units derived, either actually or conceptually, from molecules of low relative molecular mass. In many cases, the addition or removal of one or a few of the units has a negligible effect on the molecular properties. This is a definition that actually not only applies to molecular properties, but also to macroscopic properties. As shown in figure 3, what we see here is the boiling points and melting points of alkanes and polyethylenes with N-methylene units, as denoted on a log scale on the abscissa. So all the way on the left on the N-axis are small alkanes, methane, ethane, propane, butane, and so on, whereas further on the right, we come to polyethylenes. And as we see that, whereas the boiling point curve, that's the black one, sharply raises and then at some point stops when it has reached so high temperatures that upon further heating, the molecules will decompose rather than the substance will start to boil. The melting points, represented by the blue curve, actually level off in a plateau, denoting the melting points of long-chain polyethylenes. So for those, it indeed doesn't matter whether we add or remove a few repeating units. The melting point doesn't care about this and stays more or less the same, perfectly in line with the IUPAC definition of a polymer. A striking feature of polymers is that they are highly irregular. This is a consequence of the statistical nature of making polymers. Polymer formation processes and reactions are in the focus of the organic chemistry part of this class. And as you see there, these processes are all governed by statistics, causing a highly pronounced irregularity and non-uniformity of both the chain local structures and total lengths, and therewith also overall masses. Already along one single chain, there can be structural irregularity if there is multiple ways of how monomer units can be connected, such as head-to-head versus head-to-tail versus tail-to-tail connection, as shown in figure 4. On top of that, if there is also different possible stereochemistries of monomer-monomer interconnection, referred to as tacticity, we can also have some irregularity, referred to as isotactic versus syndiotactic versus atactic sequential connectivity, as illustrated in figure 5. For multifunctional monomers, such as diene monomers, there is even more ways of interconnectability, as shown in figure 6, that shows to you different possibilities of diene monomer interconnection in the example case of the monomer isoprene, which can either be connected to trans 1,4 polyisoprene, cis 1,4 polyisoprene, 1,2 polyisoprene, or 3,4 polyisoprene. The two upper ones are also referred to by their common names gutta-percha and natural caoutchouc. We will come to these two substances later on in this lesson unit. On top of this local structural irregularity along one single chain already, there is also pronounced inhomogeneity, that means non-uniformity, of the chain lengths and therewith also of the chain masses in an ensemble of multiple chains. This is referred to as polydispersity. Figure number 7 shows a typical molar mass distribution curve in two representations. The large main diagram shows the most typical representation, which denotes the frequency of occurrence on the ordinate of different molar masses in the sample denoted on the abscissa. The inset small representation in the upper right corner represents an integral form of that, in a sense that all chains in the sample up to a certain molar mass m on the abscissa is plotted as a summary cumulation on the ordinate. Such distribution curves can be determined experimentally by separation techniques that separate or fractionate a polydispersed sample into multiple narrowly dispersed fractions, which are then analyzed by suitable methods, and together that information yields a distribution curve. For practical purposes, it is often sufficient not to work with the entire distribution curve, but only with some characteristic averages of it. These are illustrated by the dotted lines in Figure 7. In polymer chemistry, we commonly use one or two out of three characteristic averages, which are named number average molar mass, weight average molar mass, and centrifugal average molar mass, often also referred to as Z average, whereby the Z stands for the German Zentrifugenmittel. The averages can be calculated from the distribution curve on the basis of so-called moments of the distribution function. In mathematics, moments of a distribution curve generally reflect its characteristic properties. The so-called first moment, by and large, reflects the arithmetic average. The second moment has to do with the width of the distribution. And the third moment has to do with the skewness of the distribution. The way of how moments are calculated is denoted to you by the handwritten formula. Basically, the feature of interest, in our case the molar mass, is summed up over all of its representations in the sample, weighted with a weighting factor, which is also named argument, which is here the number, the weight, or the Z fraction of the occurrence of certain molar masses in the sample. As said, we in polymer chemistry are primarily interested in the three averages, number average, weight average, and Z average, and those averages are calculated from the moments of the distribution by ratios of them. For example, the number average calculates as the ratio of the first and the zeroth moment of the number-weighted distribution function. The weight average calculates as a ratio of the second to the first moment of the number-based distribution function, and the Z average calculates as a ratio of the third over the second moment of that number-based distribution function. The number and weight average can also be imagined illustratively. What the number average denotes is, as its name says, the number weighted averaging over the molar masses in our distribution. That means we consider our sample and make ourselves clear that it consists of such and such many chains in total, all of which having different masses. And the number average mass, or molar mass, denotes the average value calculated simply by counting together number fractions, which illustratively means such and such many chains out of the total of such and such in our sample have masses so and so, such and such many chains in the sample have masses so and such and such many chains in the sample have masses so and so. And then we average over that. The weight average uses the weight fractions as basis. That means here we don't count numbers of chains, but weight fractions. In a sense that we say our sample has a total weight of such and such, and of that total weight of such and such, that subfraction of subfraction weight such and such is composed of chains with chain mass so and so. That fraction of subfraction weight so and so is composed of chains of weight so and so. And that subfraction of subfraction weight so and so is composed of chains with chain weight so and so. to fill this with some numbers, it could read like, our sample has a total weight of 1 gram, and of that 1 gram, 0.1 grams are constituted by chains with weight such and such, 0.7 grams are constituted by chains with weight such and such, and 0.2 grams are constituted by chains with chain weights such and such. We can imagine already that the latter average puts more emphasis on the heavy chains in the ensemble. The heavy chains in the weight average have stronger emphasis than the light chains in that kind of averaging, whereas in the number average, all of them have the same emphasis. Mathematically, this reflects itself such that in the calculation of the weight average in the numerator of the ratio, the individual molar masses mi enter as squares, whereas in the number average calculation, they enter linearly. The z-average molar mass puts even more emphasis on the heavy chains, in the sense that in that calculation, the individual masses mi in the numerator of the ratio enter as cube values, with a power of 3. The different molar mass averages can also be determined experimentally. A prime method of determining the number average molar mass is the technique of osmometry. What we need to determine a number average property in general is an experimental method that probes and quantifies an effect that scales with the number of molecules in the sample. Such effects are known to you from your elementary physical chemistry education as colligative properties. The three representatives of those were the phenomena of boiling point elevation, freezing point depression, and osmotic pressure. In that row, the latter example, osmotic pressure, is the most pronounced effect out of these three. And so this technique is primarily used in polymer science to determine the number average molar mass. Because in a polymer sample, due to the large size and large weight of each individual macromolecule, we only have a few molecules. And so we need a method that is particularly sensitive in giving a strong measurable effect even when only a few molecules are in the sample. And that is the case for osmometry. We will see how exactly that works in our last lesson unit of this class. The weight average molar mass is determined by a different technique, namely static light scattering. We will see how this exactly works in the last lesson unit of the second part of this class, Physical Chemistry of Polymers 2. The Z-average, as its alternative German name Zentrifugenmittel already indicates, is determined by the method of ultracentrifugal analysis. To give this some illustrative image, let's consider an example. Let's consider a hypothetic sample that consists of 100 chains in total, 10 of them having a molar mass of 100,000 grams per mole, 50 of them having a molar mass of 200,000 grams per mole, 30 of them having a molar mass of 500,000 grams per mole, and 10 of them having a molar mass of 1 million grams per mole. If we calculate the number average molar mass according to the formulas we have just outlined, the outcome is a value of 360,000 grams per mole. This value denotes to us that a hypothetic monodisperse analog sample that consists of also 100 chains in total, but those all with the same molar mass, would be composed of chains with a molar mass of 360,000 each. This hypothetic monodisperse uniform sample would show the same osmometric properties as our polydisperse one. If we calculate the weight average for this hypothetic sample, the outcome would be a value of 545,000 grams per mole. This value denotes to us that a sample made out of chains that are all uniform in mass with a mass of 545,000 grams per mole each, footnote of which we then would have less than in our original sample. We wouldn't have 100 in total, but only 66 in total there to make up the same overall mass in both samples, would show the same light scattering properties as our polydisperse example sample. By comparison of those values, we see already that the weight average, 545,000 grams per mole, is a lot larger than the number average, 360,000 grams per mole, because the fraction of the heavy chains in the sample, specifically those with individual weights of 1 million grams per mole, receives more pronunciation in calculating the weight average than it does in calculating the number average. For the sake of completeness, the Z average in that example would be 722,000 grams per mole, which is because it pronounces the heavy chains even more. A hypothetic monodisperse sample that would consist of only chains of that molar mass in a total number that retains the overall sum mass would show the same ultracentrifugation properties than our original polydisperse sample. The broadness of the molar mass distribution is reflected by a quantity named polydispersity index, often referred to as PDI, which definition is just the weight average divided by the number average molar mass. As you can see from the organic chemistry part of this class, typical numbers are 3 to 10 for the case of uncontrolled free radical chain growth polymerization, PDI is somewhere in the range of greater than 2 for step growth polymerization, such as polycondensation or polyaddition, and values just slightly above 1 for a quite sophisticated approach named quasi-living radical polymerization, and a value of approaching exactly 1 for the type of so-called living polymerization, which is most predominantly achieved by the experimentally demanding method of anionic polymerization. This means that in such samples, weight and number average are in fact the same, and that means that the distribution is infinitesimally narrow. The distribution function for chain growth and step growth polymerization is named Schultz-Zim distribution, expressed by equation 1.1. It also has a variant named Schultz-Flory distribution, as expressed by equation 1.2. It denotes the frequency of occurrence of a certain degree of polymerization P in the ensemble in the form of its weight fraction in the ensemble. And this is expressed as a function of the degree of conversion of functional groups in such a process, or alternatively, if we consider the case of a free radical polymerization, as a function of the probability for chain propagation relative to the sum of probabilities of all other steps that can occur, such as chain recombination or chain termination by transfer. So in other words, then this is the ratio of probability of a chain growth step to occur relative to the sum of probabilities of any step to occur. You get to know this in more detail also in the organic chemistry part of this class. This distribution function is delimited from another one, which is named Poisson distribution, which is this very narrow distribution obtained in the case of living anionic polymerization. It's expressed in equation 1.3. And as we see from the following equation 1.4, this one indeed gives a very narrow distribution with a PDI that approaches 1 as the polymerization proceeds. The derivation of the Schultz-Flory distribution is something that is also featured in our lecture script or accompanying textbook. For the sake of keeping this digital lesson unit short and concise and conceptual, I would like to not discuss this in detail here. If you're interested in that, you will find this laid down in equations number 1.5 up to 1.27. We already spoke about properties of polymers. What are the most striking properties of polymers? Well, first of all, we can say that polymers exhibit properties that are strikingly dissimilar, or let's say remarkably distincted, from the ones of classical low molar mass components. This is due to the ill-defined structure and large size of the polymers. Table number 1 compiles some examples of such distinctive properties. For example, whereas the composition of classical low molar mass materials is uniform and well-defined, sometimes all the way down to the stereochemistry, the one of polymer materials, as we've just seen, is polydisperse and irregular. The solubility of classical low molar mass components is also well-defined. There is a well-defined dissolution equilibrium that we can calculate, giving us a certain grams per liter or moles per liter concentration up to which a certain substance of interest dissolves in a certain medium of interest. This is also somewhat different for polymers. If we want to put it down in a nutshell, there is something like an all-or-nothing behavior for the solubility of polymers. We will get an understanding about the why of this later on in our class, in chapter number 4 of our lecture, featured in the 7th and 8th lesson unit. We can already take a glimpse on that by making us clear the following bottom line. In general, mixing of a component A, which can be a solute, and a component B, which can be a solvent, has two contributions, an energetic one and an entropic one. Entropy is always in favor of mixing, because mixing creates disorder. However, entropy does not have such a big pronunciation in polymer systems, as compared to systems composed of low molar mass components, which is because in a polymer system, a certain given amount of solute, like let's say 1 gram, is composed of just few molecules, because the molecules are large and heavy, and thereby we only have few of them in a given mass amount. Whereas in a low molar mass substance, 1 gram commonly contains a lot of molecules, because they are small and light. This means that although we still create disorder when dissolving a polymer, we do so with much less extent than we would do if we would dissolve the same mass amount of a corresponding low molar mass substance. That means in a polymer system, it really comes down to energy to be in favor of mixing, as entropy does not have much to say there, so to speak. Energy, however, in general, is opposing mixing. Because if you want to mix a component A with a component B, what is happening on a molecular scale? You break AA contacts and you break BB contacts and therefore newly establish 2 AB contacts. And whatever interactions make up these contacts, be it permanent, induced, or randomly fluctuating dipolar interactions or hydrogen bonding, A can best do so with another A, and B can best do so with another B. Because whatever structural motif, meaning functional group, is responsible for a certain kind of interaction in A and in B, it finds itself as a counterpart to do so in another A, respectively in another B, and therefore whatever interaction is present between these molecules, it is best establishable between A and A and between B and B, but not as perfectly between A and B. And so, the molecules very generally prefer to interact with their own kinds than with other kinds. We can put this short in the proverb, birds of a feather flock together. That means energy generally disfavors mixing. Mixing usually still happens though, because entropy drives it. But as we have just seen, entropy doesn't have much power in polymer systems. And so, in polymer systems, mixing actually only happens if energy also is in favor, or at least not overly in disfavor of it. And if that is the case, then even great amounts, or in other words, all of a polymer sample dissolves in a given fluid. Whereas if this is not the case, then virtually nothing dissolves. This causes this more or less all or nothing solubility behavior. Strictly speaking, it's not exactly an all-or-nothing behavior. Strictly speaking, there is also a dissolution limit and accompanying limiting dissolution concentrations in polymers, but it practically comes down to that. We can generally boil this down to more or less an all-or-nothing behavior. Melt behavior is another class of properties featured in Table 1. Low molar mass materials usually form low viscous fluids. There are some high viscous examples, such as glycerol, which is built out of molecules that have very strong mutual hydrogen bonding interactions, but most low molar mass substances still or though display low viscosities. This is different, very different actually, in polymer systems. Those systems are usually very highly viscous, or even no longer purely viscous, but actually viscoelastic. The reason is again that polymers are large molecules that need great energies of activation for relaxation and flow, and in which the building blocks need long times to displace themselves over distances at least equal to their own large size. And that causes, as we will see in great detail in the second part of this lecture series, high viscosities. On top of that, the long chain molecules can even mechanically entangle with each other, if the chain length is high enough for that, by the way, which imparts even further a great hindrance on their motion. The result of this is a rich mechanical versatility from elastic snap over viscous creep and relaxation to viscous flow. And that is the prime reason for which polymers have entered multiple fields in industry and our lives. And due to that relevance, large portions of the second part of this class are devoted to that, namely the large chapter number 5 in our curriculum. The last point entered into Table 1 is purification aspects. For low molar mass materials, you know typical purification steps and procedures such as distillation or crystallization from your organic chemistry education. From your organic chemistry laboratory courses, you may actually know that you practically spend 90% of your time in the laboratory doing that. You typically spend 10% of your time calculating your reaction and carrying it out, and 90% of your time in separating the mess you have created. For polymers, this is different. Polymers are hard to crystallize and impossible to distill due to their ill-defined structure and large molar mass. However, what works really great for polymers is the method of precipitation. This actually relies on the all-or-nothing solubility that we have just discussed. When we think about a polymer in a solvent that is a good solvent, meaning having favorable monomer-solvent interactions, and we then turn this solvent into a bad or non-solvent one, for example, by gradually decreasing temperature or by gradually adding a co-solvent that turns the mixture into a non-solvent. What happens is that the polymer, according to its practically all-or-nothing behavior, turns to the nothing side and precipitates. Low molar mass impurities, such as residual monomers or catalysts that are still present in the solution from the polymerization reaction, remain dissolved, because for those low molar mass substances, entropy is the main mixing driving force, and for those small components, this quantity is pronounced, keeping them in solution. And that means we here actually have a quite easy means of isolating the polymer from the mixture. We just need to turn the solvent into a bad or non-solvent one, precipitate the polymer, and then isolate and separate it by simple means of filtration. And then we may do this over again 2 or 3 times. That means redissolve and re-precipitate the polymer. And at the end, after this experimentally quite easy procedure, we have a quite well-purified material at hand. So we see that purification of polymers indeed is much easier than purification of classical low molar mass components that you know from organic chemistry. This discussion has shown to us that polymers have properties that are quite dissimilar or distinct from the ones of low molar mass materials. Why is that? As we have just discussed already, a prime reason is the large size of polymer molecules. We can also view this from a more general perspective and make us clear that with that, polymers are a prime representative of a class of materials named soft matter. What is soft matter? This term refers to, as the name indicates, materials that are soft. The general physical grounds on which that lays is that soft matter is all materials that are composed of building blocks that are large, meaning building blocks in the colloidal domain with sizes of some tens to thousands of nanometers, that have interaction energies in the range of only some tens to hundreds of multiples of RT at room temperature. Footnote in this context. Do you recall from your elementary physical chemistry education what the value of RT at room temperature is? It's about 2.4 kilojoules per mole. From now on and forever, do no longer forget this value. Why? Because as prospective chemists, you always need to argue with energies. When you discuss reaction mechanisms, for example, you discuss what kinds of bonds are broken and what kinds of bonds are newly formed. You discuss the energy cost that you have to spend for breaking the bonds on the educt side and the energy gain you make by forming new bonds on the product side. Energies of covalent bonds, such as those you regard in such examples, are in the range of some hundreds of kilojoules per mole. 350 kilojoules per mole is the benchmark for a carbon-carbon single bond, for example. The value of RT at room temperature of 2.4 kilojoules per mole now serves as a ruler for this. It's like the step width on the energy ladder, so to speak. I can give you an analogy. If I say to you, this building over there is 10 meters tall, that information is only valuable, is only meaningful for you if you know what 1 meter is. If you don't have a clue what 1 meter is, then the information that that building over there is 10 meters tall is totally meaningless to you. Then you have no clue whether this building is tall or short. If you know what 1 meter is, however, you can judge this information. The same is the case for energies. If we take the value of 350 kilojoules per mole for the carbon-carbon single bond as a reference, we can now say that this is a lot more than RT at room temperature. This means this bond is a lot stronger than what we have available thermally. In other words, this bond is closed. This bond is tight. We need substantial energies to break it, which can be provided by either severe heating or by irradiation with electromagnetic radiation in the UV wavelength range. By contrast, interaction energies in biological systems, such as hydrogen bonding patterns in DNA, for example, are a lot weaker. They are in the range of just 10 to 20 kilojoules per mole, meaning of only a couple few times RT at room temperature. And this is an energy which is not substantially higher than thermal energy, which then means that whereas these interactions are strong enough to keep things together, they are also weak enough to allow these things to be separated when needed by input of just a little additional energy or application of suitable biochemical auxiliaries. A prime example is the double-stranded DNA, the double strands of which are held together by both hydrogen bonding and pi-pi stacking interactions. And this gives an entity that is connected together in a stable fashion, but that can also be separated again if necessary, which is always the case when the DNA shall be copied or read out. Energy scales of that magnitude are very typical for soft matter. Together with a building block size of some tens to hundreds of nanometers, we can actually even estimate physical parameters, such as the elastic modulus. The elastic modulus is a constant of proportionality in Hooke's law, which connects stress and strain in a material subject to external deformation. And so this is an engineering property that tells us how hard it is to deform a material. Microscopically, this has to do with the cohesive energy density in the material, with the density of energy that holds the building blocks in the material together. The stronger this energy is, and the shorter the distances is over which it is operable in the material, the harder it is to macroscopically deform the object, and vice versa. The energy density is roughly the interaction energy divided by the volume over which it is operative, meaning divided over the cube of the typical inter-building block distance in the material. If we calculate that, so if we take the tens to hundreds of RT at room temperature as the energy and the tens to hundreds up to thousands of nanometers as the size and therefore also distance between the building blocks, which are the typical orders of magnitude of these quantities for soft matter, we end up with energy densities of some thousands to roughly 10 million newton per square meter. And this is typical elastic moduli of polymeric or colloidal materials. Hard classical materials, by contrast, come along with considerably stronger interaction energies and with smaller building blocks and therefore also with smaller building block distances because these are normal molecules or atoms in those materials. There, the energy density turns out to be in the range of trillions of newtons per square meters. This is roughly the elastic modulus of diamond. From the great difference of that latter value to the former one of polymers and colloids, we see that deforming hard matter is a lot harder than deforming soft matter. This is what has shaped the name soft matter. A third property of soft matter is that despite its comparably weak interaction energies, it takes comparably long times for the building blocks to migrate, to displace against each other, which is again due to their large size. The microscopic timescale it takes for the building blocks of a soft material to switch their positions, which means the time it takes for the building blocks to migrate over distances equal or larger than their own sizes, is referred to as relaxation time. We will get to this quantity in a lot more detail in the second part of this lecture series. For polymeric and other colloidal materials, these relaxation times, due to the large size of the building blocks, are in the range of some milliseconds to seconds, sometimes even minutes up to hours. This is ranges which are of actual practical application relevance. Because this is the everyday timescale on which we operate with materials. And that means that these materials show a rich viscoelasticity depending on the timescale of observation. And footnote, as we also will see, depending on temperature. On some timescales, the materials more display their viscous properties, and on other timescales, the materials more display their elastic properties. This is what we refer to as viscoelasticity. Polymers are a prime representative of such soft matter. The shape of a polymer chain, as we will see in our next lesson unit, is that of a random coil with a couple of 10 nanometers in diameter. This is right in this colloidal soft matter domain. The relaxation times of polymers, as just said, are in the range of milliseconds to seconds, and the chain-chain interaction energies is mostly via van der Waals type interactions with energies right in the domain of some tens of RT at room temperature. This means that polymers are a prime representative of soft matter, and that means that, in addition to the large and wide practical relevance they have, they are also of very fundamental interest, because studying polymers is easy, as they are large and slow, and so it's possible to observe them, with a view, for example, to study how phase transition and ordering phenomena occur, simply by means of optical microscopy. The insights that we gain from that are transferable also to classical materials, because the basic physics of these phenomena is the same, irrespective of the building block size. It's just larger and slower for polymers versus faster and smaller for classical materials. This fundamental insight has brought the French physicist Pierre-Gilles Degenne the Nobel Prize in Physics in the year 1991. And Degenne was it who framed the term soft matter and introduced polymers to be a prime representative of it. Let's have a little look on the history of polymer science. We have touched it here and there already throughout this lesson unit, but let's have a look on this systematically. Polymers actually have been in use by humanity ever since. There is reports that are thousands of years old on the use of materials such as natural cotton, silk, or bitumen in Mexico, China, and the Orient, as summarized in Table 2. That means for centuries and millennia, humans have actually extracted polymer-based matter from natural resources and made use of them. With the discovery of North America by Columbus, further materials such as natural rubber and gutta percha, remember that was the cis and trans 1,4 polyisoprene that we have touched upon earlier already in this lesson unit, were discovered and became useful for man. Rubber is a material that we well know that is used everywhere in our world. The prime example is in car tires. It is gained from natural caoutchouc, which upon treatment with sulfur turns into a rubbery elastic polymer network, and that is what gives rubber. Gutta percha is a variant of that. The name derives from the Malayic gutta, which means rubber, and percha, which means tree. So it's a derivative of the Malayic word for rubbery tree. It's a dried latex of that plant. It's harder than caoutchouc at room temperature, but softens at 50 degrees Celsius. And it turned out to be an excellent isolating material that was used to wrap submarine cables, transcontinental underwater cables, for telephone communication between Europe and North America in pre-satellite communication times. A little anecdotal, but also worrisome footnote in this context. Underwater cables for telephone connection were replaced with the onset of satellite communication later on. But quite recently, a sort of re-emergence of that technique has been witnessed when the stock exchange of New York and London were connected by an underwater cable that was laid along a geodete line to give the shortest possible distance on a spherical surface, with the intent to make trading faster by 6 milliseconds. Apparently, our economy has accelerated to a point where even a further speed up of only 6 milliseconds makes enough profit to make worth that investment. I actually have a hard time finding that inspiring. The onset of industrial polymer science was when Charles Goodyear came across the ability to gain rubber by sulfuric treatment of natural caoutchouc. This is a special milestone in the historical development of polymer science because it is the first industrial scale modification of a polymeric precursor from a natural resource and therefore signifies the advent of a new chemical industry in that field. There is a famous anecdote about the discovery of that by Goodyear, according to which this was actually discovered accidentally. Goodyear founded a company to produce waterproof rubbery articles in Roxbury, Massachusetts, but this caoutchouc turned out to be a soft glue substance when heated, whereas it was brittle in the cold. Goodyear, who was training himself as a chemist, however, turned out to be quite persistent in searching for a method, and he tried various approaches to achieve that, none of which successful. In 1839, however, by accident, he dropped a sulfuric caoutchouc mixture onto a hot plate, and the result was a dry and durably elastic substance. As we know today, the chemical process behind this is three-dimensional cross-linking, that means network formation, of the caoutchouc chains by sulfur bridges. As a tragic footnote in this context, Goodyear was not at all successful as a businessman. Despite the great commercial success that his method later on had, for example, in the automotive industries, Goodyear was poor all along his life. He actually was sentenced to prison several times because he was not able to pay his debt. A newspaper once wrote about Goodyear, "If you see a man wearing shoes, coat, and hat made out of caoutchouc, but without any sand in his pocket, then you have seen Charles Goodyear." We can conclude from the listing in Table 2 that for a long time mankind has used polymers from natural resources, and largely since the mid-19th century, chemists actually even modified biopolymers, but this was all done without knowledge on their primary macromolecular structure. A common belief to that time, by contrast, was that polymers are colloidal aggregates, that means colloidal clusters that are actually composed of smaller, classical low molar mass molecules, lumped together in ill-defined colloidal scale aggregates. This hypothetic picture was able to explain the actually large molecular weights that were measured in experiments, such as in osmometry, which, however, people could not believe to be actually true to that time. A reason might have been that organic chemistry was very successful in assessing low molar mass molecular structures, whereas physical chemistry to that time was quite successful in assessing low molar mass molecular interactions. And so scientists might have been prone to apply both to polymer type matter too. In Table 3, we see a display of some hypothetic colloidal formulas of the polymers caoutchouc and cellulose, as people believed them to be in times before 1920. We also see the modern, so to speak, actual chain structures of these substances as we know them since 1920. What happened in 1920? In 1920, Hermann Staudinger, the founding father of polymer science, published a groundbreaking paper entitled Überpolymerisation, in which he denoted polymer materials not to be composed of colloidal clusters of small molecules, but instead of chain-like entities that are composed of a repeating sequence of segmental units connected together in the form of chains. The proof of Staudinger was delivered by so-called polymer analogous reactions. Three of them are shown to you in Figure 11. What Staudinger did was to treat polymer materials with reagents and thereby transforming them into new materials with new properties. However, upon doing so, the high molar mass was retained. Staudinger drew the right conclusion out of this observation by constituting that this can only be explained by assuming polymers to be composed of a covalently jointed chain-like sequence of monomeric repeating units. The modifying chemical reactions, such as those shown in Figure 11, modify these chains at their side groups, but they don't break or prolong those chains, and therewith they don't affect the high molar masses of them. If the other conceptual picture were true, if polymers were constituted by loose colloidal aggregates of well-defined, actually separate low molar mass units, changing those would substantially change their interactions, and thereby change the aggregate size, perhaps even down to full breakage of the aggregates. As an analogy, consider spherical micelles of surfactant molecules. If these surfactant molecules are chemically alerated, for example, are esterificated, then these surfactant micelles drastically change in size, up to completely falling apart. None such observation was made for polymers, though. Those retained their original high molar masses while still displaying considerably different other chemical properties. This proved that the chemical modification indeed worked, but it did not break the entities. And that is not explainable by the picture of loosely aggregated colloidal clusters, but only by the picture of covalently jointed linear chain molecules. As a footnote, this ground-shifting finding by Staudinger was actually first expressed really carefully by him. In an original wording, Staudinger said, "If one is willing to imagine the formation and constitution of such high molecular components, one may assume that primarily a combination of unsaturated molecules has taken place, similar to the formation of 4 or 6-membered rings, but that for some reason, potentially a steric one, the 4 or 6-ring closure did not happen, and now many, perhaps hundreds of molecules, are jointed." The original German wording is, "Will man sich eine Vorstellung über die Bildung und Konstitution solcher hochmolekularen Stoffe machen, so kann man annehmen, dass primär eine Vereinigung von ungesättigten Molekülen eingetreten ist, ähnlich einer Bildung von 4 und 6 Ringen, dass aber aus irgendeinem, eventuell sterischen Grunde, der 4- oder 6-Ring-Schluss nicht stattfand und nun zahlreiche, eventuell hunderte von Molekülen sich zusammenlagern." This notion and conclusion actually received harsh criticism in the scientific community. For example, expressed by people who were actually personally close to Staudinger, such as his predecessor in Freiburg, Heinrich Wieland, himself Nobel Prize laureate in the year 1927 for the structural characterization of bile acids, who once wrote, "Dear colleague, refrain from the imagination of large molecules. Organic molecules with a molecular weight above 5,000 do not exist. Purify your products, such as the caoutchouc, and then they will crystallize and turn out to be low molecular components." The original German wording is, "Lieber Herr Kollege, lassen Sie doch die Vorstellung mit den großen Molekülen. Organische Moleküle mit einem Molekulargewicht über 5000 gibt es nicht. Reinigen Sie Ihre Produkte, wie zum Beispiel den Kautschuk, dann werden diese kristallisieren und sich als niedermolekulare Stoffe erweisen." Staudinger, however, proved persistent and proved his hypothesis and later on got more self-confident. In the 1930s, for example, he expressed, "Even though the formation of millions of compounds whose molecules are built of hundred or several hundreds of atoms is possible, this realm of low molecular organic chemistry is just a pre-stage to actual organic chemistry, namely chemistry of compounds that are of fundamental importance for processes in life. This is because the latter compounds contain molecules that are not built from some hundreds, but from thousands, 10,000s, and perhaps even millions of atoms." The original German wording is, "Wenn auch die Darstellung von Millionen von Stoffen möglich ist, deren Moleküle aus 100 oder einigen 100 Atomen aufgebaut sind, so bliebe dieses Gebiet der niedermolekularen organischen Chemie trotzdem nur die Vorstufe der eigentlichen organischen Chemie, nämlich der Chemie der Stoffe, die für die Lebensprozesse von grundlegender Bedeutung sind. Denn in letzteren Verbindungen liegen Moleküle vor, die nicht aus einigen hundert, sondern aus Tausenden, Zehntausenden und vielleicht sogar Millionen von Atomen bestehen." Again, we remember the quote from Bruno Vollmert's book Grundriss der makromolekularen Chemie in this context, saying that polymers are the highest level of complexity in chemistry and the lowest level of complexity in biology. A little footnote in this context, Staudinger had a very important co-worker during that time in Freiburg, who was Günther Victor Schulz in the years 1933 to 1941, who later on became a professor at Rostock and then in Mainz, where he re-established the university after World War II and re-erected the chemistry faculty, literally out of World War II ruins. This fundamental work of Schulz at the place of Mainz has certainly led the fundament of Mainz to become one of the most renowned places for polymer science in Germany, Europe, and the world. Schulz's contributions to Staudinger's work was in providing experimental techniques to actually carry out molecular weight or molar mass estimates, primarily through ultracentrifugation, later on also by viscometry and light scattering, and yet even later on by chromatography-based separation and analysis of molecular weight distributions. Schultz also worked on the thermodynamics and kinetics of polymerization processes and is most famous for his discovery of the Schultz-Flory and Schultz-Zim molecular weight distribution functions that we came across at the beginning of our present lesson unit. In the following decades after Staudinger's groundbreaking experiments, the core concepts of polymer physics or physical chemistry of polymers were developed. Examples and cornerstones were the Kuhn model for polymer chain renormalization that we will get to know in our next lesson unit, the Flory theory of polymer coil conformation in a good solvent, which we'll get to know in chapter number 3 in our fifth lesson unit, the Rouse and Zim models for polymer dynamics, as we will also get to know in chapter 3 in the sixth lesson unit of this class, the Flory-Huggins mean field theory of polymer thermodynamics, as we will treat in chapter 4 in the seventh and eighth lesson unit of our class, and the statistical theory of rubber elasticity, which will be featured in chapter 5 in the second part of this lecture series. In the 1960s to 1980s, these concepts were further developed and refined to move from the description of single chains to multi-chain assemblies. And that was the time when French physicist Pierre-Gilles Dejeune discovered that methods developed for studying order phenomena in simple systems can be generalized to more complex forms of matter, such as polymers, and by the way also liquid crystals. And that led to the emergence of a whole new field, which is soft metamaterials. Current research in polymer science has two main directions. The first direction is to further bridge the polymer world with the life science world and to understand how polymers provide a basis and act in even more complex functional units and entities, which in turn are the basis of living systems. That is actually done in concert with the, I would say, actually youngest field in chemistry, which is supramolecular chemistry. And supramolecular polymer science is a very livingly evolving field of its own in these times. It actually comes along with a quite funny twist in the myth, whereas in the times before Staudinger's notion, polymers were recognized to be composed of units that are connected by non-covalent forces in the form of colloidal clusters. In supramolecular polymers, we actually do that. We connect monomeric entities by non-covalent forces, but not in an ill-defined aggregate fashion, but in a well-defined chain-style fashion. The second great branch of polymer science these days is that, in retrospect, we can say that polymers have shaped mankind's last century in a very fundamental fashion. Ages and periods in mankind's history have always been classified according to the most relevant materials to those times. We think about the Stone Age, the Iron Age, or the Bronze Age in this context. Following this scheme of classification, we can undoubtedly term the 20th century of mankind's history as the Polymer Age. Polymers emerged into every branches of our lives in those days, having made it a lot more comfortable. Nowadays, though, we have to get rid of the negative consequences of this development. There is tremendous, huge amounts of polymer-based waste that is polluting our environment and impairing life on our planet. So modern research, both industrial and academic, has an obligation to develop techniques and approaches to address this challenge and to furthermore develop new polymeric materials that are as useful and functional as the existing ones, but that are degradable and reprocessable. Further current research in the polymer field is to develop polymer-based materials that serve to attenuate the consequential damage of mankind's most severe crisis, or let's better say emergency, which is man-made climate change. That all requires a sound understanding of structure-property relations of polymers. And as a result, physical chemistry of polymers is a key discipline. It is not only of outstanding academic fundamental interest, but also of outstanding actual relevance.